Good evening. My name is Andrew Guy, and I'm a student project supervisor at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. On behalf of the Clark Forum and Dickinson College, I would like to welcome you to tonight's event, a lecture by Professor Philip Zelikow entitled The Twilight War. Tonight's program is the inaugural event for this year's Clark Forum theme, Security Challenges of the 21st Century. At this time, I would like to ask that you turn off all cell phones and electronic devices. Our event this evening will begin with a memorial service led by Mira Hewlett, Director of Religious Life and Community Service at Dickinson College. Please welcome Mira Hewlett.
This past weekend, throughout our nation and our world, communities remembered and reflected upon the 10th anniversary of September 11th, 2001. Tonight, we're going to take a few moments before our featured speaker to do the same. We all remember where we were that day. Maybe it was driving to work, it was sitting in a coffee shop, or in the classroom. I was a junior in college at the time and at the gym when all of a sudden the program I was watching was interrupted by sights that were unseen before. The confusion of a plane crashing into the World Trade Center became instant news. And in the coming hour, as planes crashed into the second tower, the Pentagon, and in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, it was all so strange. September 11th, 2001. Throughout the day and even the week, the stories continued to unfold. Terrorism on American soil in a scale unseen before. And that day, it made very real the dangers that so many throughout the world were used to and continue to face on their own soil today. Stories of people who were lost, including Dickinson alum Melissa Harrington Hughes of the class of 1992, who was working in the Trade Center at the time, the family she left behind. Stories of children, orphaned by parents who were killed at work, by parents who were killed in the Pentagon, or because they were on the wrong flight that day. On that day, a new definition of hero was unfolded. Heroes were firefighters who went into the dangerous blocks of New York when the towers were falling to help people they didn't even know. Heroes were police and Port Authority staff who went to help the wounded, rushing into instead of away from danger. Heroes were the 40 people on Flight 93 who took control of a plane that was destined for Washington, D.C., preventing the deaths of an additional 100 people. In total, 2,977 people from over 90 nations died in the attacks on September 11th. Left behind are children who never knew parents, spouses, parents, friends, all honoring the lives of loved ones that they lost. As we commemorate these citizens, we honor and celebrate the resilience of their family and friends and communities on every continent who stand up against terrorism. We draw on the spirit of humankind, seeking once again that unity would envelop our nation and our world so that we would seek peace in every land for every person. Tonight, we're going to hear briefly from two students who were living in New York City in 2001. After their brief remarks, we're going to do a guided meditation to remember and to reflect upon those that we lost. Please join me in welcoming Nina Tirado and Jonathan Baez.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Nina Tirado. I'm a freshman here at Dickinson, and I was born and raised in the Bronx. We gather here today, 2 days after the 10th anniversary of the 9/11 World Trade Center tragedy. Unfortunately, the painful memory of planes flying into the World Trade Center, smoke rising from the Pentagon, and learning where Shanksville, Pennsylvania, has become a part of our nation's history. As a third grader attending school in New York, It was unreal that the World Trade Center had gone up in flames. As a child, I used to pass the Twin Towers on my way to my mother's job, which was right around the corner. When my teachers in my elementary school asked me to pack my things and leave with my aunt, I was utterly confused. No information was disclosed to any student other than to evacuate the building immediately. As my aunt and I drove home, she was in tears, but I couldn't comprehend why. When we finally got home, I turned on the television and realized that the building my mother worked in was covered in smoke and dust. Panic and worry overcame me. As a third grader, it was unbelievably impossible to imagine life without my mother. But thankfully, she came home later that night, covered in filth from helping those stuck in crumbling buildings. Even with burning buildings and countless deaths, people were still eager to help in any way they could. Firefighters, police officers, and rescue workers ran into burning and crumbling buildings to save innocent lives while thousands were running out. Many died, not just because of the deteriorating buildings, but also because of failed rescue attempts. Sirens and shrieking voices was the tune of Manhattan for many days. As I pass Ground Zero now, sadness obviously comes to the surface, but what overpowers that sadness is the feeling of unity. Never have I seen people of all ages, heritages, and religious backgrounds come together to help one another without any selfish benefit for themselves. Ground Zero has become a symbol of strength of all nations against terrorism. September 11, 2001 will forever be a day ingrained in all of our hearts. As we move forward from this tragedy, let us remember the victims and the victims' families who are still mourning their losses, as well as the women and men who serve our country daily to protect freedom worldwide. Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Jonathan Baez, and I'm a senior, born and raised in Bronx, New York. 9/11, a time and an event that shaped who I am. It has helped me understand this concept of unity. United we stand, united who stands. I always knew I was from New York, but never knew what consists of being a true New Yorker. New York consists of so many different people. How can we possibly be united? I was in sixth grade in my homeroom class at 9 o'clock in the morning when my substitute teacher, Ms. Gilbert, ran into the classroom screaming, "New York City's under attack." We all ran into the window where we had the perfect view of the World Trade Center, or what we knew as the Twin Towers. Both the picture and feeling is still fresh in my mind. I remember the image of black smoke rising up in the air. I remember the fear in my peers' faces. I was confused. I was frightened. What's happening? What was going on? 10 years has passed since 9/11, and now I'm a senior here at Dickinson College. During this 10-year period, I learned so much from this experience, this concept of unity. Something that was so unclear before has now become clear. Despite New York's diverse demographics, I learned that 9/11 has brought us closer as a community. The businessman from Wall Street, the mother in Queens, the skater boy in Union Square, the yellow cab driver, every random native New Yorker I've met, we all share a common experience. And Ali, that's what brought us closer. And by us, I mean me and the 80 nations who have lost a loved one, me and the public transit riders, me and you, me and everyone who was affected by this unfortunate episode. 9/11, a time that has emotionally scarred us for life, but subsequently united us as a nation. Confucius once said, "The strength of a nation derives from the integrity of the home." He also said, "Our greatest glory is not in never falling, but in rising every time we fall." I want to give a special acknowledgement to our everyday heroes, the firefighters, the police officers, the doctors, the nurses, the teachers, to anyone who contributes to the well-being of our loved ones. We have fallen, but we are not defeated. I love New York. Thank you.
Let us now enter into a time of guided reflection, pausing to remember. We remember the people from over 90 nations who perished in the events of September 11th. We remember their friends and family who still mourn their loss today. We are thankful for the everyday heroes who went to extraordinary effort to help those in need, and for those that continue to serve today. We remember the unity of our nation as we came together not in fear, but in solidarity and with resilience. We are thankful for the men and the women who serve in our armed forces, called to secure peace throughout the world. We stand beside those from other nations who continue to fight terrorism today and tomorrow and every day to come. We remember the call to service in our own communities as a way to meet the challenges of our nation and to be more unified today than in the past. Amen.
Thank you, Mira. We all remember where we were when we learned of the tragic events of September 11th, 2001. As many of us watched on our television screens that day, we questioned how such an attack could occur on American soil. When it came time to answer this question, the United States government assembled the 9/11 Commission. Serving as executive director of this commission, our speaker tonight, Philip Zelikow, played a crucial role in ascertaining the facts of the September 11th attacks and in shaping the Commission's recommendations for reform. Prior to his service as executive director, Zelikow worked extensively in the government and in academia. He served in the United States Department of State and later the National Security Council under President George H.W. Bush. Leaving government work, he taught first at Harvard University, and later at the University of Virginia, where he became the director of the Miller Center of Public Affairs. Following his service on the 9/11 Commission, Zelikow became a counselor to Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. Since then, he has returned to the University of Virginia, where he is the White Burkett Miller Professor of History and Associate Dean of Graduate Programs. Last week, he was appointed by President Barack Obama to serve on the President's Intelligence Advisory Board. Following tonight's presentation, there will be a question and answer session. Please hold all questions until this time. Because this event is being taped and some audience members may be hearing impaired, please wait until the microphone has been brought to you before asking your question. A book sale and reception in the lobby will follow the event. Our guests will be available to sign the recently issued edition of the 9/11 Commission, in which he wrote a new important afterword. And now, please join me in welcoming Professor Philip Zelikow.
Thank you, Andrew. Thank you, Andrew. I'm glad to be here and glad that Dickinson College and the Clark Forum have given me a chance to revisit Carlisle. I was here about 2.5 years ago, but then I was a guest of the United States Army. And so I'm glad to have a chance to come back and experience the civilian side of Carlisle. Of course, we're all moved by the scenes that we've been reliving over the last few days, evoked for us just a few minutes ago in the memorial service that began tonight's event. As we reflect back on 9/11 and the last 10 years, what we all start with are experiences, our own experiences. And we pull those into images stuck in our heads. And then from those experiences and images, we try, as human beings always try, to somehow construct meaning out of that, some sense of it. We all have our own memories associated with the tragedy of 9/11. In my case, I can remember one more person going to ground zero shortly after the attack. And the striking thing about it, aside from the horrific visual scene of the place, is this awful pungent smell that you'd notice as soon as you got into Lower Manhattan. It reminded me so strongly of the smell of the operating room theater, that smell of singed flesh that you experience if you're watching open heart surgery, as if the terrorists had opened up some special sulfurous path to hell. Or later, directing the commission investigating what happened, I have these vivid images in Afghanistan, south of Kandahar, tramping in my boots through the Tarnak Farms camp, where a few years earlier bin Laden had once had his headquarters, piecing through the wreckage, trying to imagine what it had been like. Or another image, there I am, I'm in a Washington office, leaning into a loudspeaker to listen one more time to the cockpit voice recording recovered from United 93, trying to match that up with what we have on our screens, the reconstruction of the behavior of the aircraft that came from its flight data recorder, trying to put it all together, painstakingly trying to reconstruct moments of agony and astonishing courage. We all have a need to construct meaning from occasions like these. In the rare cases when a historical event, especially a traumatic event, stirs emotions on a massive scale, touching many millions of people, it enters popular culture. Great numbers of people soon form beliefs about what happened and why. People usually try to make sense of events in ways that fit their prior understanding of how they think the world works. But sometimes a catalytic event opens their mind to new possibilities. In this case, the scale of danger that might be posed by an organization of zealots based on the other side of the planet in one of the most primitive countries on Earth. But a terrible crisis is also an occasion for discovering more about ourselves. After all, think, why do you read stories about tragedies? Why are people drawn to such narratives on television, in the movies, and novels that you pick up to read on the airplane? Partly because vicariously going through those events helps you witness the worst and the best that it brings out in people. The worst and the best that such things can evoke in a society. We saw that Americans can produce an Abu Ghraib. And we saw the daring professionalism displayed by an Abbottabad. Thus, we can use this crisis to reflect on who we are, what we have learned about ourselves, and what we have learned about who we can be. Consider, too, images of others. Consider the face the Arab world has presented to the rest of the globe. The whole decade has been bookended by a struggle within an Arab and Muslim world trying to cope with the strains of modernity and globalization. Some extremists found the root of their troubles elsewhere, in America or Europe, an agenda sometimes attractive to clusters of alienated expatriates living overseas, and others whose restless energy is displaced onto a distant enemy abstraction, because, of course, they really didn't know almost anything about us or our society. It was an abstraction to them, a thing that gave their lives meaning in a narrative of their devise. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, for instance, was truly a man without a country. On 9/11, then, the world was introduced to one face of this Arab and Muslim struggle, a set of fanatical mass killers. That image lingers. 10 years later, and for 6 months, the world has been watching Syrians protest against their tyranny. These unarmed men and women gathering in the streets face every horror a clever, malignant regime and its creatures can devise. They suffer the deaths and terrifying disappearances of family members and friends, a toll now numbered in the thousands. Then, against all odds, they turn out again the next Friday, and the next. For this American, raised as I was to black and white television images of civil rights protesters facing their oppressors, the smuggled, fragmentary images of what the Syrian protesters are enduring week after week, month after month, present as astonishing and heroic a display of raw, sustained civic courage as I have ever seen anywhere in the world. This image should linger too. On Sunday morning, I was at Ground Zero, along with P.J. Crowley from your faculty. We were on a terrace in 2 World Financial Center, where all the media cameras were gathered in order to film and observe the ceremony from that vantage point, a singular vantage point. And of course, we're there in part, P.J. and I, and I'm going in front of cameras, and I'm trying to explain to TV audiences, in this case, British TV audiences, people who watch the BBC anyway, trying to explain what it all meant. And I have to say, as I reflect back on it and the things that I said, and of course I tried to be facile and clever, I'm struck in a way by the inadequacy of my own ability to articulate meaning from all of it. I'm humbled, actually, by my own failings. Because there is some core of this, at some level, presents almost a conundrum to us. It seems such an overwhelming thing on one level, when you're sitting there watching them reading the names, as that sailor's bell tolls as they interrupt for silence on the anniversary minutes. And at some level, though, there's a quality of meaninglessness to it. Meaninglessness. The consequences, of course, are just absurdly disproportionate to the people who carried this out. This handful of crazy young people coming from around the world to do this, that such people from such a place could cause this kind of calamity is at such a level of absurdity that it defies any conventional narrative that we would attempt to construct around it. And of course, we'll try nonetheless to construct the narratives, to give it the facile meaning in our sound bites and the TV shows as I do. But it's worth stepping back from that and just reflecting on that quality of it. Think about the shape of a classic narrative. We read these stories, these confrontations of good and evil, and usually, of course, you want Sherlock Holmes to be opposed by Dr. Moriarty. You want, you know, great good to be opposed by great evil. I grew up, for example, and was trained in government in the old days under the apocalyptic shadow of nuclear danger. But that had a certain grand apocal narrative about it, of the division of the world into camps, struggling over how to organize modern societies, bristling with huge assemblages of men and metal to face each other in this contest. So the narrative, in a way, made sense. It had a grandeur about it that we can teach in history courses. Somehow, this is not like that. When we say that bin Laden represents a world historical force, or we say, as an acquaintance of mine has, that this is now World War IV, to borrow his phrase, No, it's not. Bin Laden is not Hitler. He is not Stalin. This is not Stalinism. This is not a world historical force. Don't do them that favor of elevating them to make them fit a grand narrative by making them grand. That's their fantasy. That they are confronting the United States on that epochal scale. But it's a fantasy. It's not real. That's not who they really are. That's not who they really represent. So don't do them that favor. There's a deep problem of narrative proportion, in a way, that we have to struggle with, because as humans, we need these narratives. And they need to have a certain proportionate feel to them. And this events like these defy this quality. To give you an example, before 9/11, this 9/11 was not the first intercontinental attack by this group. It was the third. The first in 1998, they blew up nearly simultaneously two American embassies in East Africa. That was a highly complex transnational operation. We threw a few cruise missiles at them, more or less fecklessly, and did nothing meaningful after that. Our report gives you details. Then in October of 2000, they blew up and almost sank a Navy cruiser, a Navy destroyer docked peacefully in Yemen. Killed 17 sailors. We did almost nothing about that, as we debated in Washington whether or not we had enough evidence that it was Al-Qaeda. Well, we probably was, but was probably good enough. But actually, part of the problem is we didn't really know what to do meaningfully about it. The idea that, well, you need to go in and clean out this wasp nest, because if you just let them keep stinging you, maybe someday they're actually going to sting you and it's really, really going to hurt. You just kind of let them keep trying. But that would require some massive thing in Afghanistan that seemed still deeply disproportionate. And of course, it was inconceivable that we would do something so disproportionate right up to the morning of September 11th. It's literally so inconceivable that no one even wrote it down as an option in the options papers. And then on the afternoon of September 11th, not only was it conceivable, it was obvious, and indeed obvious that it should have been conceivable for the last 2 years. And the shock of that realization is powerful. As you begin to realize, we needed to have thought of this way in a way that defied all our usual notions of proportionality in the thinking about our policies. So in a way, again, these narrative conventions are not equipping us well for this new kinds of threats that this generation, I think, will find increasingly common. For those seeking perspective on the Al-Qaeda phenomenon, which reached its peak strength between 1999 and 2001, a suggestive one, actually, is the rise of violent anarchist groups in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, especially the period between about 1890 and 1910. Centered in countries such as France, Italy, Germany, Russia, and Spain, and expatriates from those countries, many of them living in the United States, this movement spread to the U.S. and elsewhere, mainly through immigrants. It had a few charismatic icons, men who were then very well known, names like Prince Peter Kropotkin or Enrico Malatesta, names forgotten now, who spread the word while in exile, inspiring all these cells of people around the world. Sound familiar? The scattered groups exalted the propaganda of the deed, as they called it. Cells of anarchists around the world, sharing little more than this common inspiration, carried out sensational attacks, including the assassination of the King of Italy in 1900, and then a year later, the assassination of a United States president, William McKinley. So at the time, many people tried to make the struggle against these Reds, which is what they called them back then, these anarchists, the defining struggle of the age. The new president after McKinley's death was a man named Theodore Roosevelt. He gave a speech to Congress in December 01. Quote, "Anarchy is a crime against the whole human race, and all mankind should band against the anarchist. His crime should be made an offense against the law of nations, like piracy, and that form of man-stealing known as the slave trade, for it is of far blacker infamy than either, It should be so declared by treaties among all civilized powers. A war against anarchism was what Theodore Roosevelt called for in December 1901. But the fever cooled very quickly. Actually, some of the other civilized powers took him up on his idea right away. The Russians and the Germans took the lead in drafting a treaty, a secret treaty, that would have obliged all the signatories to work against anarchists, the St. Petersburg Treaty of 1904. They presented it to the Americans and asked them to sign in 1904 to President Theodore Roosevelt's administration, and they refused to sign it. The fever had already cooled even in Washington. They were uneasy about the fact that Russia and Germany were the leaders of this cause, because they kind of understood a little bit about how what the Russians and Germans were doing with their own agenda of hunting anarchists. And the notion of a secret treaty that would enlist America in this cause, anyway, folks had begun to feel a little more uneasy about that. And looking back today, if you ask historians today, what did it all mean, all that anarchist phenomenon? I think that actually the historians today will look back and see this strain of violent utopianism as having been a symptom of alienated people in societies undergoing wrenching change, reacting to oppressive rule, and finding the only outlets that seemed available to them. In no case did anarchists actually seem likely to establish governments of their own. The anarchist movement of that era was instead an outlet of fury. It seems ominous to us now as a precursor to movements that would more effectively exploit such anger and such dreams. Any good analogy like that one can only suggest questions, not provide answers. For our time, one of those questions is where the anger will lead us now. Islamist revolutionary movements were already active by the middle of the 20th century, focused on conditions at home. Intensified by evangelical rivalries in the 1980s between Iranians on the one hand and Saudis and Pakistanis on the other, more globally oriented groups, including Al-Qaeda, gathered strength during the 1990s. Repression at home and media depictions of Muslim struggles at the peripheries of the Islamic world channeled restless energy towards these groups and their faraway jihads. It's useful to remember that the Hamburg cell, including Mohammed Atta, that volunteered for service and became the future hijackers, actually initially volunteered for service in Chechnya against the Russians, and then were later simply turned by their leaders to going after a different target. After September 11, 2001, though the core of Al-Qaeda was dispersed, mainly into Pakistan, the massive engagement of the U.S. and its armed forces in places such as Afghanistan and Iraq kept Muslim attention focused on America. Suspicion about the U.S. remains high. But the American role in the Muslim narrative is moving away from center stage. U.S. forces are leaving Iraq this year. And though Arabs may not be pro-American, they are not pro-Al-Qaeda either. Seeing how his adherents slaughtered so many Muslims, bin Laden's popularity had already been waning. Yet, bin Laden's presence had remained spectral and defiant, at the edge of consciousness for cults of fantasists. He was the ghost in the machine, blessing attacks on the almost equally imaginary enemy, promising that their lives would become truly real and meaningful at the explosive moment of their deed. Now another deed, this one by U.S. forces in Abbottabad, has shattered that crystal. Some sleepwalkers will look anew at the world around them. Before the 9/11 attack, there was a classic paradox in thinking about the terrorist danger, what I call a paradox of prevention. As the 9/11 Commission observed, quote, "It is hardest to mount a major effort while a problem still seems minor. Once the danger has fully materialized, evident to all, mobilizing action is easier. But it then may be too late. Al-Qaeda was most vulnerable in the years before 9/11. But before the catastrophic scale of the potential threat was manifest, massive action to counter it, like serious U.S. military efforts against the Afghan sanctuary, seemed so disproportionate as to be inconceivable, as I said. So this was a genuine paradox. It defied obvious solution. That pre-9/11 paradox of prevention about the Islamist terrorist danger is actually long gone. It now applies to other problems. A different kind of paradox has now taken its place. A paradox of adjustment. The danger of global Islamist terrorism is greatly reduced from what it was on 9/11. The core Al-Qaeda organization, even in Pakistan, is probably down to no more than a few hundred reliable operatives. Richard Reid, the so-called shoe bomber, was overwhelmed by airline employees and passengers as he tried to ignite explosives in his boots on an airliner preparing to land just before Christmas in 2001. 8 years later, on Christmas in 2009, trying somehow to attack the United States, the best Al-Qaeda's affiliate in Yemen could do was to repeat the Reid operation, this time with an operative overwhelmed by airline passengers and employees as he tried unsuccessfully to ignite explosives in his underwear. An attack could still happen at any time. Like the attempted destruction of an airliner on Christmas Day 2009, there have been other recent attempts, including a 2009 plan to bomb New York City subways, akin to the Madrid railway bombings of 04 and the London subway bombings of 05, and a 2010 attempt to explode a car bomb in New York City's Times Square. A gun massacre, like that in Mumbai in 2008, or in Norway earlier this year, is another obvious danger. Any attack will be publicized sensationally. Thus, any president who downplays the danger, trying to right-size the enemy and put the danger into a more normal proportion, invites humiliation if there is an attack. If there is no attack, public acts of reassurance invite an unwanted dulling of concern. For both these reasons, the cultural momentum of 9/11 rolls forward. The result in 2011 is the public image of the enemy that the commission described in 2004. Quote, Al-Qaeda and its affiliates are popularly described as being all over the world, adaptable, resilient, needing little higher-level organization, and capable of anything. The American people are thus given the picture of an omnipotent, unslayable hydra of destruction. Close quote. The paradox of adjustment is that efforts to right-size, to normalize a reduced risk seem too risky. Yet the reality is that the most serious threats are posed by a relatively tiny number of people, fewer in number and less well-organized than the crew organized for production of any one of Hollywood's larger films. A handful of deluded people derive most of their power not from their strength or the power of their ideas. They get their power from us, from our society and our culture. Our narrative gives them meaning. This paradox of adjustment also is genuinely tough to solve. If there is a way out, it may just be a gradual process. But a catalytic event noticed by many millions, like the death of Osama bin Laden, can also help politicians turn the page, at least a little. And as we downsize from Iraq and Afghanistan, the American people will face important choices as to whether and how they turn the page. Contemporary societies will remain vulnerable to the abilities of even a few people to do terribly disruptive things. But I wouldn't trade the age I grew up in of apocalyptic nuclear danger for the age we live in now. I think that that was actually a more dangerous period in world history than the period we're in now, by some margin. This disruptive feature of our age is not unique to the danger posed by Islamist fanatics. A principal function of 21st century government, the government all of you will shape and live under, will be how do you manage a process of healthy adjustment to the kinds of risks that are endemic to this generation, developing more systemic and transnational defenses to more systemic and transnational threats. Think about in twilight wars like these, which may become more and more the tendency of the future. How is the country to be defended? By whom? Under what rules? We've actually seen the rise of the CIA into being a combatant command. It runs the most important guided missile program in the U.S. government, not the armed forces, although behind the scenes, the Air Force actually buys the missiles and mostly flies them. But you have a CIA then, it's become in a way our new Defense Department. Will that be the future Defense Department? And we'll have this enormous formal Defense Department and an Army War College that trains people to fight the wars we don't want to fight anymore. And then we'll have this kind of unofficial Defense Department in this working in this gray area of murky authorities and murky governance, and who actually is in charge of it, under what are their rules of engagement, and they're the ones who actually will fight the real wars, the twilight wars. I believe actually in the next few years, we need to engage in a process of adjustment as to how we readjust this for the new normal and make it normal, not murky and temporary and something that we don't really understand, normal enough so we're sure it comports with our values as well as protecting our security. At the cultural level, too, a process of adjustment includes adjustment to failures. For there will be failures. The supreme measure of a mature professional institution or a government is how it handles failure. Its capacity for honest self-examination and thoughtful accountability. This is one reason why my commission colleagues and I took a pretty hard view of the poor quality of work exhibited by parts of the government in its initial reconstructions of what happened on the morning of the 9/11 attacks. This dimension of institutional integrity is, in the long run, vital to the country's well-being. In air travel, for example, and the example on which I'll close, where societies have adjusted to constant risks of catastrophic failures, maybe the greatest virtues of America's National Transportation Safety Board, the NTSB, agency that many of you perhaps have never heard of, maybe its greatest virtues are cultural and political. Aside from the particular talents of the board's employees, the NTSB represents a habit of thought and earned trust. Something goes horribly wrong. Many people lose their lives. A respected institution will examine what happened professionally, rigorously. It will explain to the community what it learned. The community will further reduce the risks. And millions of people will board airplanes each day. They go on with their lives. Thank you.
It is now time for the question and answer session of the program. So if you have a question, please indicate so by raising your hand and getting the attention from Tad, Alex, Andrew, or myself, and we'll bring a microphone to you. And please, please wait for the microphone to reach you before asking a question. So let's now begin with the first question.
Hi, thank you for coming. I thought your assessment of how lone wolf type perpetrators could be the most dangerous in our society, I think you gave the example of the Norway attack. I was a little curious the fact that you didn't mention the Fort Hood massacre that happened almost 2 years ago, in which a man who was turned out to be communicating with a terrorist cell in Yemen became part of our military for many years and then murdered numerous military servicemen and women on a military base. And I wanted to ask you, you know, do you believe that was a legitimate terrorist attack, just as you believe the Cole or the Oklahoma City bombing or the first World Trade Center bombing were terrorist attacks? And if so, how serious do you think the threat is of people like that individual infiltrating institutions like the military, U.S. government agencies, or prominent American businesses and committing heinous acts like that that kill many Americans and instill fear in millions more? Thank you.
Well, we have a problem. Modern societies have a problem of lunatics who get guns and kill a bunch of people to address something in their lives. The Nidal Hassan case you're quite right about actually is the most, that in the last 10 years is the most serious act of Islamist-motivated terrorism carried out on American soil, the 13 people killed at Fort Hood. If you had told me 10 years ago that that's the worst we would get, I would have wiped my brow with relief at the thought. But it's still extremely serious. Now, I live in Virginia. In Virginia, we had a young man who had a university not too far from my university, killed 24 people one morning for reasons that only he can understand and explain. You saw the Norwegian case, another set of different motives. The Nidal Hassan case is especially tragic because, as you observed, he was in contact with a gentleman named Anwar al-Awlaki while he was in the military, and then explained to his military bosses when he was lightly asked about this, well, because part of his project in the military as an officer is he was doing a study of Muslim behavior and Muslim extremist groups, and this is just part of his work. It's kind of like the kind of dog ate my homework excuse you might give to one of your professors. And actually, they kind of it turns out that some of the folks who initially looked at that bought it. Some FBI folks in San Diego who looked at this did not buy it, and were pressuring folks in Washington to work the case much harder, and the investigation fell apart for reasons that have been discussed in some of the investigations of that since. In other words, as in many of these lunatic cases, sometimes the lunatics do things before they act that in retrospect could have given you cues that they were dangerous people and needed to be stopped, and there were some particular cues in this case in that position of responsibility. But my larger point is a lot of things like this are going to happen. Actually, the most serious extremist attack that's occurred on American soil in the last 20 years was carried out in 1995 by Timothy McVeigh, an ex-Army soldier, and his Confederates driving a truck bomb into the federal building in Oklahoma City and blowing up half the federal building and killing 150 people. Now, he happened to be motivated by right-wing extremism, which was a much more important phenomenon in American society in that particular period in 1990s. I don't know what things will inspire alienated people who need to act these things out because of problems in their lives. What we need to learn as a society is how we adjust to this endemic danger, because it's happened before and it will happen again, and it could happen in much worse forms than the Nidal Hassan case. Some of the people in this business think that we've actually been fortunate so far that much more serious assaults have not already occurred. And then we need to fortify ourselves as a society, though, to become resilient. That if something much more serious does occur, we don't say to ourselves, aha, the grand narrative really is true. Six people in their 20s really should move the entire United States of America, and it's 300 million people, to focus on what those 620-somethings think is important, just because they were able to kill a bunch of people one day.
Thank you for coming. My question is, you brought up that you see a shrinking difference between military activities and intelligence activities. There are many who agree with you and think that we should join Title 50 and Title 10 of the USC to combined and rewritten Title 60 as legal guidance for these blurry joint operations that you described. But doesn't this perception of a need to legally combine the two undermine the utility of having both?
For those of you who are not versed in Title 10, Title 50, and didn't know what the questioner was talking about, let me break the code for you, because this question is a very good one. I actually happen to agree with the merger idea, and the 9/11 Commission called for that in one of its recommendations. Title 10 is the part of United States law under which the U.S. military classically operates, you know, in which you do military things and you do them openly and in uniform. Title 50 is that portion of U.S. law that authorizes, quote-unquote, covert actions, where we do things secretly in which we wish to deny that the U.S. government is involved in what happens. That's by the, now, the military does things that are secret or clandestine, but they don't pretend that the U.S. isn't doing it. Under Title 50, we have certain legal authorities for intelligence operations that are done or meant to be done in a form where we wish to deny or pretend that the U.S. government actually had nothing to do with it at all. That's a covert action. So what we've historically, and this is partly for legal reasons, but actually partly also for cultural reasons and the way we've chosen to interpret these laws, we've tended to say all the covert action stuff is only done by CIA, and all the other stuff, like special operations forces and night raids, that's done under Title 10 by the military. But then the problem is, well, does that mean that we need to actually have special operations military guys in the CIA who can do all these things when we need them to do them in an especially secret way? So, for example, the drone program, which is probably the worst-kept secret in the United States, is operated under Title 50. And so it's operated in a distinct way, and since this has been on the front page of all of the nation's newspapers many times, I can just say that's where I learned about it. But the... If you set up a situation where we have a special paramilitary capability in the CIA built up larger and larger and larger to fight twilight wars, and we have another special operations ability over in the military, and actually what ends up happening, of course, the CIA people and their contractors are trying to hire away the guys working in JSOC, which was a problem in my experience, and which to me made no sense. But the issue then is, do we really want to have these military capabilities artificially divided, or shouldn't the president simply have the flexibility to do what we did in the bin Laden raid, which is what the president wants to do is he wants to blend these in whatever way is functionally best. So if soldiers do the best soldiering, then let's try to get the soldiers to do that. And so we hire, train, recruit soldiers, and we build camps to train them, instead of basically setting up another group of soldiers in CIA who the military will train and then CIA will hire them away to form its army. No, the CIA is especially good at certain things. The military is especially good at other things. How do you blend these capabilities to give the president the most flexible set of options and then get the law, get the legal form to follow function, rather than the other way around? You see, the commission made this argument, for example, because the biggest military opportunity to go after bin Laden with human beings was in 1998. There was a capture operation developed to go after bin Laden in 1998, first half of 98. The story's in the commission report. It was developed entirely within CIA as a military operation working with some Afghans who they'd hired to help them. So you have this problem is CIA basically develops a military operation. It's a fairly complex military operation, as you might imagine. They kind of show it to the military people, and the military people say, kind of looks interesting, plausible to us, but, you know, we're not responsible for any of this, right? We're not actually taking any ownership. They say, you know, But you know, by the way, the same phenomenon that happened for the Bay of Pigs operation. The military kind of watched what the CIA was doing and was noncommittal. And the CIA developed it, and of course, the Bay of Pigs, they went forward and it didn't turn out well. In this case, in 1998, the operation went up to the top policymakers, and they looked at it, and it was a CIA military operation, and they just didn't have enough confidence in it that the CIA could do this. And so Sandy Berger, the National Security Advisor, and the CIA Director George Tenet turned it off. And actually, that was probably the last chance to do a human operation against bin Laden, probably, that one in 1998. So that's an example of the other side of what happens by creating this artificial divide. You create military operations that don't command adequate confidence in the military professionalism. And then meanwhile, the military over here gets these big muscle-bound operations that don't have the flexibility and agility you might want them to get from working with the CIA guys. And the good news about this is that since we made our recommendation on trying to blend this together in 2004, frankly, a lot of folks in the field have just done the workaround. And I saw this myself in Iraq and in some other places, and we've basically built blended operations in which people are working very closely together in the field, and they've just tried to figure out how to paper it up to try to get it past the lawyers. But I think for the long haul, as we figure out what do you want CIA to look at 3, 4, 5 years from now, and what do you want it to do, where do you want its high-level attention mainly to be focused? On this problem, doing these operations, or on other things, and in what balance? And then how does the military need to evolve so that it can do what you want it to do in these twilight wars? And that's where we get at ideas like trying to meld Title 10 and Title 50 a little more than we have in the past. Sorry for that. May seem like an arcane inside the beltway digression, but issues like these are actually the kinds of issues that will end up defining the posture we're going to have a few years from now.
How much concern do you have that national hysteria becomes institutionalized in the dominant political movement, to which you somewhat alluded, because the anarchism, the anti-anarchism of the early 20th century became institutionalized in Germany, and it turned out badly, from what I understand.
Obviously, I think that there's a real concern that, see, we develop a grand narrative that exaggerates the scale of the enemy, that so it'll, the narrative will make better sense to us. And you can remember some illustrations of this over the last 10 years. And that's obviously an ominous tendency. But lest everybody come away from this thinking, you know, Zelikow is a pacifist who thinks the terror threat was hugely exaggerated, my position actually is very peculiar, I'm afraid. See, I actually think to some extent we're exaggerating the threat now. Yet actually, I thought before 9/11 we didn't take it seriously enough. I actually think, and I must say I wrote some things in 1998 and later, that actually was arguing we should do very disproportionate things before 9/11. That people would have thought were taking the threat too seriously then. Yet now, I'm actually taking the position that we're taking the threat too seriously. And it's not just a uniform position in which I think these things are always trivial. It's just in this case, I actually think we've knocked this threat back a good deal. And therefore, the task of political leadership is, how do you solve this paradox of adjustment? Because for a politician, the paradox is real. I mean, I can intellectualize about it, but it's just a really hard problem, even for someone who really means well and is conscientious about it. Because you don't want to invite complacency, and you don't want to invite political suicide, because then you'll get this backlash that may make matters even worse for you. So how do you guide a process of adjustment? One thing you look for are catalytic events in mass culture like the bin Laden death, and then use those, or some other things like the drawdown in Iraq, which, and people are going to have a visceral sense that somehow the story is changing. And more the way you talk about this and talk about other things may just be a product of gradual adjustment. But it is a challenge for political leadership to get this stuff right, just as opportunistic politicians will, of course, seize the opportunity to exaggerate things and scare people and use the politics of fear, because fear is a very powerful and motivating emotion.
How do you believe this new psychological idea that we need to keep an eye on terrorism will impact non-military defensive policy for the United States in the next 10 years?
I'm sorry, say that again.
How do you believe this psychological position of having to keep an eye on terrorism, in other words, active threats against the United States, will impact the non-military sector of defense policy for the next 10 years?
What do you mean by the non-military sides of defense policy?
Focusing more on the intelligence community instead of the U.S. Army, for example.
Yeah, okay. Actually, I think that if you go over a list of what do we think are the most important challenges facing the United States, most of them do not have a conventional military form, including the problems of transnational violence. I mean, for example, the most serious problem of transnational violence today affecting the United States is in Mexico. There are more people murdered by transnational groups in Mexico in the last 2 years than in both Iraq and Afghanistan put together. And add in Pakistan, and Mexico still beats it out. And that's right on our borders. It just doesn't fit into any of our narratives, although America is intimately connected with this problem in a bunch of ways. But it's clearly not a problem that's going to be solved by sending in the 1st Cavalry Division or various maneuver brigades. But is there some role for the military? Yes, and some role for intel. But oddly enough, actually, a lot of the key issues is the harmonization of domestic policies. So, for instance, our drug control policies and gun control policies, which we think are domestic policies, are in fact the critical policies for this new period. Which is, by the way, let me just kind of stay on this riff for a minute, if you'll let me. Because I wrote an essay about this a couple of weeks ago that I think is an important idea. And so I will, in my vanity, share it with you. Which is the whole way I grew up thinking about foreign policy is foreign policy is about the relations between states and how you adjust the relationships between states. You know, this power block versus that power block, all that sort of thing. I grew up with that. I'm very accustomed to that. But I'll make an argument to you that the main substance of foreign policy today is no longer the adjustment of relations between states. It's actually the adjustments and harmonization of domestic policies of different states. It's the coordination of their domestic policies, their fiscal policies, right? Their capital adequacy requirements for banks. The cybersecurity issues, which are so hugely important right now, but if you actually get into the cybersecurity subject, all the particular policy issues present themselves as domestic topics. The authority and expertise to deal with issues like how do we monitor network operations, what kind of architecture should the internet have, look to the people who work on them like domestic issues. Though, of course, if you think about it for 5 minutes, you realize it's not just domestic, because what you see is what we think is a domestic issue, fiscal policy, capitalism, development issues, energy, natural resources, public health, and we just go on and on the list. What we think is China has the same set of issues, and so does Russia, and so does India, and so does Europe. In other words, we're all facing the same set of domestic issues. How we harmonize what we do about them is increasingly defining the substance of the foreign policy. Our foreign ministries, of course, don't have either the authority or the expertise on most of these subjects. So they look to heads of states to somehow solve these problems at a summit on climate change like Copenhagen, and of course, which turns out to be a complete bust. Because actually the problem, if you think that the challenge of foreign policy in the future is harmonizing the disparate domestic policies, we actually haven't developed institutions for that world yet. And we're slowly adapting them, including the way our Defense Department thinks about these issues and the way our intelligence community thinks about these issues. This is a really interesting adjustment that your generation is making.
Do you think one problem in right-sizing the threat, however, is keeping the term or using the term war? Because war has such cultural significance, its own kind of narrative. We win wars, you know. We don't, just maintain the threat. That we have to get rid of the concept of war in order to turn the page.
Well, this problem, you're absolutely right. We have a really serious problem of how to think about war now. Now, I'm not the person to tell you that war is obsolete and a thing of the past and we don't need militaries anymore. But I will tell you that the world is changing in really fundamental ways. I don't think we're going to see large industrial wars, huge collisions of men and metal of the kind that dominated and so marked the 20th century. I do not think tank armies will wheel across the steppes of Central Asia again. I just don't think that's going to happen. If you know, we can have a particular theoretical argument about what might happen, scenarios with China or Russia or some other things that we can't foresee. And our track record, by the way, in foreseeing the nature of future conflicts historically is just terrible. It's virtually zero. This is just assume you do not know what the future conflict will be about 10 years ago, and that's the safe assumption. Is assume total ignorance and that it will be unexpected, and then that's the way to plan. But one of the things that you do notice is a lot of these sorts of twilight conflicts. The Mexico case is a really interesting illustration of this, or what's going on in Somalia, or what's going on in the Congo. And you just can give illustration after illustration of this, what's going on in Pakistan and Afghanistan. And then you think about how does America play a fruitful or constructive role in twilight conflicts like these? What capabilities will allow us to help ourselves in conflicts of this character that we might not expect? Because clearly one reaction of the American people to Iraq and Afghanistan is going to be, man, do we not want to flood the zone with American soldiers as the default response to these problems? I mean, whatever folks think about those two wars, what I'm taking from what both parties are saying is they're not itching to have another one.
You spoke a lot about the differences between our two generations. Do you think that the USSR tensions during the Cold War acted as organizing forces for the extremists and military?
I'm sorry, you'll have to. I'm having trouble understanding you.
Okay, let me try again. Do you think that the US-USSR tensions during the Cold War acted as organizing forces for extremists and militant groups, such as with the Sandinistas and Contras in Nicaragua? If so, would you attribute the rise of twilight warfare to the absence of these two opposing powers on the world stage?
Are you wondering whether or not we moderated those forces during the Cold War because they were working as our proxies and therefore we reined them in?
More so that the United States and the USSR were sort of like polarizing forces. They would supply weapons and ammunition to counter-revolutionary groups.
Well, what happened is because so much of the world was organized around this Cold War struggle, is people then oriented themselves to that, and they basically took their local fights. And they identified these local fights as part of the global struggle, and they about half meant it, and about half were using it opportunistically. And basically, I need to put things in this way so that I can get this help from these folks who have the money and guns that I want. But then there's also a level in which some of them kind of sort of believed it, kind of sort of, depending on the case. And then once they aligned themselves with the Russians or the Cubans or the Americans, then we had some influence over them, or thought we did, sometimes. And this then had all sorts of unfortunate consequences. But and partly there are cases where probably conflict was worsened or fomented because of the injection of the Cold War rivalries into fueling what would have been civil wars anyway in a place like Nicaragua or a place like El Salvador, which were already torn by and Guatemala, already torn by longstanding civil conflicts. And they just acquired that character, and they seemed more important than they were. And on occasion, maybe they were a tiny bit more important because everybody thought it was a global game of dominoes and all the rest of that. Fortunately, you live in a world, the good news is, you live in a world in which no one really thinks that the fate of the world hangs on what happens in one of these little places in that sense. I mean, for instance, when John F. Kennedy took office in January 1961 and got his transition briefing from the outgoing Eisenhower administration, President Eisenhower and his advisors told the new president, Kennedy, that the most dangerous place in the world at that moment in time was Laos. Laos. Tiny, landlocked Laos was the most dangerous place in the world for the future of the West. And people at that time believed it. They believed it. Of course, now we just don't, and there are reasons why they believed it, that you actually have to study history even to recapture the mindset in which that could even conceivably make sense. Now, of course, we would look at it purely as one more wilderness area of state failure in which some sort of bacillus might breed. You know, these petri dishes. And then, you know, what kind of measures do we need to take almost from a public health perspective? What swamps do we need to drain? And how best to drain them or contain the menaces that come out of them? But that's a very different kind of perspective and a fundamentally safer one.
Thank you for your comments, Professor. Listen, two quick questions. One of your findings, as I understand it from your commission, was to set up the DNI. I want to know how you think that's working. And did any of the Greystone project get started under any of your recommendations?
I'm sorry, which project?
The Greystone project get started under any recommendations of the commission.
You'll have to remind me what the Greystone project is, and then I can remember whether I was cleared for that.
All right, let's forget that. Just concentrate on the DNI.
Okay. I think the DNI has been somewhat helpful. This is more Washington bureaucraties, but it's somewhat important. What you had before 9/11 was you had a loose-knit confederation of intelligence agencies we called the intelligence community, more than a dozen agencies, of which about three or four of them actually are really quite large. The CIA, by the way, is not the largest of them. The NSA is larger than the CIA, and on many days more important, though the CIA is plenty important. But so you had, and you kind of like, well, who kind of organized all these different agencies and made sure they were working in concert, and there was a synergy between all the things that they did? There was a guy called the Director of Central Intelligence who had some nominal authority to write memos to people, but not very much. And so people had chronically noticed for decades that it was very hard to get to manage the intelligence community and that this was a chronic problem. The 9/11 attacks weren't caused by a failure of central management, but it was just one more illustration of problems in central management. George Tenet had wanted to mobilize the intelligence community to work much more on counterterrorism. He couldn't do it. His folks didn't even write a serious management plan for how they would mobilize them to do it in a concerted way. You know, language training, the whole bit that you would work out if you were the head of General Electric and you wanted to move your whole conglomerate on something. So the commission really kind of picked up a long-standing recommendation for reorganizing the intelligence community, made some adjustments to it, and carried it forward yet again, and this time successfully. So they created a Director of National Intelligence. And what this did is it didn't create a Department of Intelligence. I mean, we actually did a full consolidation with Homeland Security and created a single cabinet department. But with this one, rather than create a Department of Intelligence, They just turned the Confederation into more of a federation and gave it a little more, a stronger central management. But this was watered down on Capitol Hill so that the budget authority was more limited and the hire and fire authority was more limited. And the answer is, under the first leaders, it didn't work very well. Under some of the next round of leadership in the late Bush administration, it worked better, but mainly because of the chemistry of personalities and the strong support of the White House allowed them to use their informal authorities and partial statutory authorities fairly effectively. It's unclear now where this stands in the Obama administration because they've had more personality problems and the White House has sometimes been distracted. And so the jury is still out on whether it's going to work. No one's really arguing that we really wish we could go back to the way it was in the old days. Weren't things managed so much better back then? There are a few CIA diehards who make that argument, but I don't think it's convincing. Hardly anyone's really making it. The main argument is, do you stick with your federation and then just try to tinker with it and make it better? Or do you actually have to go whole hog and have a consolidated department? The last two DNIs before the current one is Jim Clapper. His immediate predecessor was Denny Blair, an admiral. His predecessor before that was Mike McConnell, another retired admiral. Both McConnell and Blair have said we need to go further and consolidate. Clapper is not in favor of that. These are all deeply experienced men from the military and military intelligence world. But that just kind of gives you a sense of the spectrum of the argument, and it's mostly can you kind of fix it without having to get Congress to pass a new law and make matters worse. But incidentally, to give you some historical perspective on this, the Defense Department went through a similar prolonged, agonizing evolution before it assumed the form we know so well today. They actually also went first to the Federation model, and then that failed so palpably that then they created the Consolidated Department. And then they had to reform the Consolidated Department repeatedly. It just happens to turn out, by the way, for you folks, that if you're interested in this subject, one of the best books that's currently available on this subject was written by a member of your faculty, Douglas Stewart. Creating the National Security State is one of the two or three things I would actually recommend to understand how the Defense Department became the way it is. It's terrific.
Congratulations on your new appointments. Good to know you're still in the game. My question to you is, as an educator, what would you advise our educators today in how they go about teaching to our children how to look at what happened on 9/11, what caused it, and how they put it in context?
I've actually found the more I try to tell my children what to think, the more likely it is they will not think it. Probably all of you, though, are much better children. I like my children a lot, but I've tried to learn something over some years of parenting. What I've found actually is mostly what you do with your students is the best thing you can do for your students is empower them and enable them to learn on their own. If you'll give them just a thorough, basic grounding in facts and how to read, and how to read critically and analytically, then you kind of roll the dice and let them figure out how to teach themselves. Because frankly, for the rest of their lives after they get out of college, and long after they've forgotten your course or my course, well, I'm sure they'll remember my course forever. But long after they've forgotten it, you'll have either succeeded or failed in teaching them how to teach themselves. Because they'll spend the rest of their life teaching themselves, according to their lights. So what you want to do is catch them in that early formative period and make them much more able to teach themselves. There, I think, the universities have an absolutely essential role in giving people fundamental cultural literacy about things like history, how our institutions work, and other societies and cultures, and expose them to a variety of things so that they can teach themselves effectively, because, frankly, the ability to learn is founded on a foundation of cultural literacy and being able to build on a lot of context and reference points that everybody else in a field understands. And if you don't have just a kind of a basic foundation of how to understand, like, some of these, if you're interested in national security, understanding what the acronyms mean, what the arguments are about, but also with some historical background to all of that, to have a sense of what's the backstory on a lot of this stuff. But if you kind of have a sense of that, then I'll feel more comfortable about rolling the dice and trusting on how well they'll teach themselves. And then as consumers of information for the rest of their lives, the quality of information that they will demand as consumers, the websites they'll choose to view as opposed to the websites they won't choose to view, because they'll understand the difference between quality and trash. And if we do nothing else in the universities, allowing our students to be slightly better judges of the difference between quality and trash is a virtue.
There is time for one more question.
Thank you for your words tonight. Thank you to Dickinson for extending the invitation to the War College. I'd like to think that we're not all training to fight those things that we don't want to fight, that some of us are actually thinking in a broader picture. Your subject about reference history 110 years ago with dealing with those actors, the threats that we don't really want to deal with, anarchy. We face that now. We had at least a decade of what was classified as criminal acts, best dealt with by the justice world, best dealt with by a different arm of government. We've invoked the intelligence community, Title 50. We've talked about the Defense Department with Title 10. What are your thoughts about the Department of Defense, as it's organized now under Title 10, moving forward into the next decade and beyond, reorganizing to work in this transnational defense, as you've talked about? Mm-hmm. How do we reorganize? How do we shape the Department of Defense to work with Department of Justice and to work with these other folks, not just through the Joint Special Operations Community, but others, to bring about a more holistic way of dealing with the resources that we've invested in Department of Defense? How do we go about doing that? How do we work through that as in the Department of Defense?
Okay. Obviously, big subject for which I should be paid a gigantic consulting fee in order to answer this. And indeed, I will need, in fact, a whole set of contractors working for me at cost plus rates. So I guess what I'll offer are just maybe just a couple of very simple thoughts. Thought number one, since if you start from where I am, which is you got to be very humble about what the future is going to require. So therefore, if you start from this point of view of profound humility, and when I was at the Army Future Game on the Strategic Advisory Panel 2.5 years ago, which Dempsey was running, there's a lot of humility in the rooms, kind of like, which war did the Army successfully predict it would be in 10 years before it was in it? None. So, but if you think back and ask yourself, so what was the most important institution America protected during the 1920s and 30s that it turned out to be absolutely indispensable, even if we didn't fight the war we expected? The infantry school at Fort Benning would be pretty high on that list if you asked General Marshall. And the point behind that little story is the capability of your people and the skills that they can master, because if you've got this extraordinary human capital and some physical capital too, but if you have this really good, these strong capital assets, then you're going to be more versatile, and you're going to have a much better cadre to be able to surge in unexpected and unpredictable directions. So actually you want to nurture that, and therefore in a way you don't want to be too tied down in mission institutions that constrain your ability to create versatile and kind of multi-directional human capital, if that's not too vague. So first is I start from the point of view of humility. The second is we need to work through some ways of getting past arbitrary divisions in the way we think about foreign and domestic divides and military-civilian divides in ways that are important but will be uncomfortable for some people. Let me just give you a really concrete illustration of what I mean by that. Let's take cybersecurity. It's very much a 21st century concern. Let's suppose that we concluded cybersecurity, that is the massive intrusion and penetration of cyberspace, large-scale theft, and the potential to implant things that could do damage to facilities and infrastructure in a conflict situation. Let's suppose that's something we should worry about. If you look around and then say, well, if I want to basically develop various kinds of defenses of my network systems, let's say network systems in the private sector in the United States, let's say the banking sector, for example, and we could put together a list. And you ask me, which agency in the U.S. government has the most expertise in figuring out how to detect hostile penetrations of computer networks and what distinctive ways might you combat them, that agency is probably the National Security Agency. You're not going to want to reinvent all the technical capabilities and human capital that the National Security Agency has amassed in another government agency just because the NSA is in the arm is built in the Department of Defense and employs a lot of military people. But now I've just talked about how do I use NSA capabilities interacting with all sorts of private sector American institutions and in areas that are traditionally the province of American domestic policy, like internet architecture and network security issues. And you think about that for a few seconds, and a lot of people will be very uncomfortable with that, including people at NSA. So this is an illustration of the kind of problem I mean. There are a lot of situations like this. And the only way you'll avoid the discomfort is simply by rolling up your sleeves and working through it in a way that's going to reassure people that the military and military techniques and powers are not being misused and abused by utilizing them where we need to utilize them sometimes in a different context. In other words, by shining some light on these issues and being upfront about what we need to do in order to reassure people about the adjustments we might need to make. There are other illustrations we could come up with like that, but that's a crystalline example. And the broader idea here for those of you who may not be interested in what the Department of Defense needs to do or not is you're going to need to think about how you adapt institutions in new ways for problems that aren't identifiable as domestic or foreign, that are just global. Even things like how do I do consumer product safety rules if I'm making a consumer product that's going to be sold in 195 countries? Or my intellectual property rules? Or how do I organize my company if I need to operate transnationally as, say, Siemens does? I mean, you know, where you don't really have a national home base that's meaningful in the same way anymore. Whose laws govern that? But you're not going to have a global government that's going to tell 6 billion people they're all part of one community because they don't think they are. And you shouldn't try to shoehorn them into thinking they are because they'll push back at you really hard. People want to maintain their community identities. How do you devise loose transnational frameworks that still allow primary communities to feel they can make a lot of self-determination? They can choose the kind of society and cities and villages and languages in which they want to live without being threatened and fearful of the globalization to which you nonetheless have to adapt. This is hard stuff, but man, it's really, really interesting. I grew up really as kind of the last generation of people who grew up and were trained to function in the classical world of international rivalries that had existed for centuries. You're, in a way, the first generation that's growing up adapting institutions for what I actually view as a qualitatively different phase in world history. I teach modern world history, and I actually think we are in a transition period that ended around the end of the 20th century, literally from one large-scale period of world history to another large-scale period of world history. And you're a generation growing up at the pivot. It's kind of exciting intellectually. Sounds like a reason to pay attention in your classes. Thank you.
Please join me again thanking Professor Philip Zalkow. And please join us in the lobby for a reception and book signing. This concludes our program. Thank you all for coming and have a good evening.